Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack
and Sean Chapman.
We are here, as always, to talk about stuff. This week in stuff, Godzilla.
Yes. The King of Monsters has returned.
Yes. Returned to theaters, second time in America, a little more successful this time.
Yeah.
Including at the box office. Holy crap.
Yeah, it's making all the money.
I was worried it was just going to flop.
Yeah, like, I didn't have like a lot of confidence that this movie would bring in huge dollars, but it definitely is.
Yes, so people are liking it. That's going to be our topic today. We're going to talk about Godzilla. A couple things to go over before that, but as always, when we talk about the movie, it'll be in spoiler terms, so don't listen to that unless you've seen the film. But our spoiler-free recommendation, Sean?
I'd say go see it. It's not, like, the greatest movie ever. Like, don't go in expecting it to be, like... It's not, I don't think it's like the best Godzilla movie, like even ignoring the first one, because you always have to kind of ignore the first Godzilla when you're talking about the best Godzilla movies. But it is a Godzilla movie. If you're a fan of Godzilla, you've probably already seen it, but go fucking see it. It's a lot of fun. So,
and I think I liked it even more than you. I really, really loved this movie. I thought it was great. And I don't have as much of an investment in the Godzilla character as you do, Sean.
Yeah.
But I just thought it was a really, really impressive summer blockbuster, more so than most of what Hollywood puts out. And I liked it so much, I've written about it twice. So I've got a spoiler-free review on the site. And then a couple days later, I posted a more in-depth where I kind of went into some story points I wanted to talk about, because this was a tough movie to review, because the stuff that impressed me most, I absolutely could not give away, I felt like.
Sure.
Because there's a twist in the movie that I thought was really interesting and took it in a direction I didn't expect, and that's kind of when I started loving the movie. But in any case, I think it's really impressive on just about every level. But we will talk about that in a minute.
Yep.
First off, Sean, what stuff have you been up to?
Mostly, like, stuff relevant to the podcast. I have been playing those two Spider-Man games I talked about last podcast, Spider-Man Web of Shadows and Spider-Man Shattered Dimensions. I have beaten Web of Shadows, and I'm, like, kind of maybe halfway through Shattered Dimensions, and it's really interesting that they are, like, complete mirrors of each other, much in the same way that Spider-Man 2 and Amazing Spider-Man 2 as movies are complete mirrors of each other. Where Spider-Man Web of Shadows, it has, like, maybe the best sort of, like, web-swinging and just, like, swinging around New York and that, like, part of Spider-Man, and it does that really well. There's a great sense of speed, and that's really fun. But the story is so stupid and just a really bad Spider-Man story, because it gets so wrapped up in all this, like, symbiote nonsense. Like, it's like a bad 90s Spider-Man story, which is, like, the worst kind of Spider-Man story. And there's a morality system, and it makes no sense to me that you'd have a morality system in a Spider-Man game, and hopefully Spider-Man is going taking care of whatever that problem is that the cops coming by. But Web of Shadows, like, the combat is really just sort of mindless. It has a lot of camera issues, especially the end game. It's a technical mess. Like, it's one of the most sort of, like, broken technically games I think I've played in a very long time, where eventually the city gets overrun by symbiotes, and so it kind of, like, has this weird zombie apocalypse vibe. But when that happens, they populate the streets with tons and tons of, like, random symbiote monsters, and the game's frame rate cannot handle it at all. So, like, in the second half of the game, when that happens, like, when you're just swinging around the city, the frame rate continually drops to, like, you know, maybe even, like, sub 10 frames per second sometimes. Like, it's just horrendous in that respect. But it's still, like, the core swinging stuff is really fun. So, if you're, like, I would say it's a solid 3 out of 5 Spider-Man game in that respect. Then Shattered Dimensions is really interesting, because Shattered Dimensions is the exact opposite, where it is really focused. It's not open world. It's, like, kind of old school in that it's, you know, specific, like, linear levels. And one of my favorite parts about the game is that all the levels are designed around a villain, and Spider-Man is trying to get to the villain, and, like, there's a lot of, like, encounters with him along the way. And the reason why it's called Shattered Dimensions is because it has 4 different Spider-Men. I'm going to say Spider-Mans. I like Spider-Mans better.
It's more entertaining.
Yeah, it has 4 different Spider-Mans, and all of them are voiced by different people who have voiced Spider-Man in the various animated series.
So that's cool.
Yeah, so you have Amazing Spider-Man, which is basic Spider-Man, who is voiced by Neil Patrick Harris, who he voiced him in a short-lived MTV series. And then there's Spider-Man Noir, which that's Christopher Daniel Barnes, who voiced him in the, like, the 90s Spider-Man series. And Spider-Man Noir is kind of like if Spider-Man was in the 30s and kind of like he's kind of like a lot of gangster stuff. And then there's Spider-Man 2099, which is my favorite version of Spider-Man 2099, because Spider-Man 2099 is like if Spider-Man was only bad 90s Spider-Man stories. And because he's like crazy future Spider-Man, he's got like, it's like Batman Spider-Man with like cyber tech. It's really shitty. But that one, I can't remember his name, but that one's voiced by the dude who did the voice on Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. So I really like that because he's like the goofiest Spider-Man with like... Because Spider-Man 2099 is super serious and dark and gritty, like dystopian future, but they make him super silly in this game, so that's really awesome. And then you have Ultimate Spider-Man, who has the black suit, and he's voiced by Josh Keaton from Spectacular Spider-Man.
Woo!
Yeah, so like all, and then all
the best
villains,
Spider-Man.
Yeah, most of the villains are voiced by people who have done voices from the show and stuff. Like I'm on the Ultimate Spider-Man mission where you fight Deadpool, who's voiced by Nolan North, who's voiced him in a lot of stuff. And so it's like, so that game, it's really focused, and the combat's pretty good. It's not amazing, but it's pretty good. But it doesn't have, like, I think the gameplay is not as fun of Web of Shadows because it doesn't have, like, that, like, immense speed and stuff that Web of Shadows had. But all the presentation and the story, like, gets it. The game is fucking gorgeous, and all the different Spider-Mans have, like, their different art styles that they go with, where Amazing Spider-Man feels like a kind of an old-school comic book style. Ultimate Spider-Man is a very sort of, like, modern, digital, colorized comic book style. Noir is all sort of, like, you know, noir-y. It's all very shadows. And then Spider-Man 2099 is super, like, saturated in your face with all the bright, like, neon future colors. And so all that stuff is really great, but the gameplay is not as fun as Web of Shadows. So it's like, if you had all the presentation stuff of Shattered Dimensions and combined it with the gameplay stuff of Web of Shadows, you'd have, like, the best Spider-Man game. Because they're, like, both 3 out of 5 Spider-Man games on their own, but if you combined them, they would be the 5 out of 5 Spider-Man game that will probably never be made. But
it's too bad.
Yeah, but they're both, if you're Spider-Man fans, I think they're both games worth playing in their own right. So, that's that.
Alright, awesome. So, the only game I've been playing is that I've been replaying Persona 3.
Yeah.
So, past the 24-hour mark. Got a lot, long ways to go yet.
Yep. You've spent an entire day, like, literally,
yes,
on that one playthrough. So,
I love just dropping facts about Persona length with people who don't know much about Persona. So, like, with my brother Thomas, he walked in at one point. And it was around the time Igus gets introduced. Mm-hmm. And if you don't know, Igus is the most important character in that game.
Yeah.
But she comes in at the 20-hour mark.
Yeah.
And I said that to Thomas. He's like, well, how can she be the most important character in the game? And I'm like, because that's only a quarter of the way through.
She's still in most of the fucking game.
Yes. So anyway, I don't have any, you know, thing new. That's a game we've talked about before.
Yeah, yeah. We have old podcasts on that.
So. Yes. So anyway, but this week in, you know, news and stuff, I mean, what was going on? It's just, there were some game announcements for, like, franchises.
Yeah.
We learned about Far Cry 4 and saw the creepiest cover art ever.
Yeah.
It
seems like they're kind of continuing on the weird tone of Far Cry 3. Hopefully they don't fuck it up the next time.
It looks,
as far as the story goes,
it looks like the cover to an animated BDSM porno.
Sure.
To me.
So anyway. I mean, you're more familiar with that kind of stuff, so I'll leave that up to your judgment, Jonathan.
Hey, where did that come from?
You're the one who made the comment about the BDSM porno. Like, I would not have ever made that connection, but sure.
It just looks creepy. That's all. You got a, like, blonde guy in a you know, like, throne petting, like, a, you know, native. It's,
yeah,
you know, creepy.
Yeah.
So, anyway. I didn't ever play Far Cry 3, so...
Yeah, Far Cry 3, really awesome gameplay, really dumb story.
Okay. So
hopefully the next one will have a better story and keep the good gameplay.
Yes, I'll probably just pick it up with Far Cry 4 because I can play it on the PS4.
Sure.
Which will be nice. There's a lot of... It's funny, there's a lot of those franchises that are kind of straddling the line coming out this fall. We're going to have that, and we're going to have a new Assassin's Creed and all these other games.
Well, the Assassin's Creed is doing a weird thing.
Oh, yes, it is.
Unity...
Right.
The really poorly subtitled Assassin's Creed game is only modern consoles, and then what, the sequel to Assassin's Creed 4? Or at least, I don't know if that's...
They haven't announced that yet, yeah.
I feel like that's what the rumor was, that there was going to be
right.
The Pirates game will be
yeah.
old consoles. Like, they're definitely making it and, like, doing the split thing, but I don't think we
right.
know exactly what the previous console game is.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, anyway, the big announcement this week, though, was that Microsoft...
Halo 5 has a subtitle. That was the big announcement.
Yeah, they announced... Well, and its timing is a little interesting here. So they announced Halo 5 Guardians, which is the first subtitled Halo numbered
exactly.
game.
Exactly. Which it kind of frustrates me as someone who thinks way too much about titles for movies or games and stuff.
Yeah.
Like, if you're starting a new trilogy and you're going to start putting in fucking subtitles, do it at the beginning of the new trilogy. You know, Halo, if you're going to start having subtitles, Halo 4 should have had a fucking subtitle, goddammit. It pisses me off.
Yeah, it's weird. But anyway, so Halo 5 Guardians, it's coming out fall 2015. They dropped this announcement just kind of in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
Why was... I was kind of confused as to why this wasn't a big centerpiece of E3. Like, they could have a big
know.
Reveal trailer and have
yeah,
it at the end.
Microsoft's E3 is... I'm really curious about what it's going to be because they dropped... they drop the fact that they're dropping Kinect, like, way ahead of time, and then now they're doing this, which seems like, you know, it's not huge news, but it seems like you would just save that for the fucking teaser trailer that's going to be in their E3 press. Like, they have not had Halo in their press conference since Halo, like, came out, basically. So, of course, they're going to have some in their press conference, so I don't understand why you wouldn't just be like Halo 5 Guardians there, like why you need to put that ahead of time.
But. And it's coming, you know, such a long way out. This is fall 2015. It's not like announcing it middle of the week in May gives them a boost on that. So we also got a little bit of cover art or concept art here where you've got Master Chief and another character.
Yeah, then that seems like actually the biggest reveal is that there is some other character. I don't know what how much of a reveal that is, but there is another character featured in the concept art or whatever it is that they put out, so.
Yeah, I think probably what they're saving for E3 in terms of a reveal is, the reports are, and this is in no way official yet, that Halo, the Master Chief Collection, will be the Halo game for Xbox One this year in 2014. Mm-hmm. And the report is that that will collect all the numbered Halo games, all the ones where you play as Master Chief, so that would be Halo Combat Evolved.
Master Chief Collection.
Yeah, 2, 3, and 4, but not Reach or ODST, and they would be... most of those are already in HD. Combat Evolved already had an anniversary edition, but the Halo 2 HD remake would be in there, and they would all be ported over to Xbox One. And Microsoft is not commenting on this yet. If this is true, I assume that's going to be the announcement at E3.
Sure.
But yeah.
That's, like, unless... The only reason that would be a big announcement is if they are doing a Halo 2 anniversary edition.
Yeah.
You know, it has been 10 years since Halo 2 came out, so it's
possible. I'm sure they are something like that.
But if they are, I wonder if they would do the multiplayer or not. Because if it's just Halo 2 campaign, like that's the weakest campaign Halo has had. So,
and it's interesting because the thing that Combat Evolved Anniversary had is that it came out right after Reach, so they just used the Reach multiplayer.
Yeah,
because
it was basically a classic map pack for Reach.
Right. Yeah, which made sense, and that was everyone liked that, and it was good. But the problem with this is that this is going to be the first Halo game on Xbox One, so they would have to create a whole new multiplayer suite from the ground up for it.
Yeah.
And a multiplayer architecture, which is not in place for Xbox One yet.
Yeah, I don't know. It seems unlikely to me that they would. I don't see Halo 2 Anniversary Edition in the future, but it might be. Who knows?
So,
I mean, like, I would not be surprised if they announced Halo... For lack of a better term, Halo HD Collection for Xbox One. That would not surprise me in the slightest, but I would be kind of surprised if they put in the work to, like, the kind of work that they did with Anniversary Edition to update any of the games.
Yeah. I mean, Halo 3 and 4 don't need it, and neither does Combat Evolved. It just had a remake. Yeah. It makes me sad that they're leaving out ODST and Reach, because those are two of my favorites.
Yeah, but... Yeah, ODST's campaign is maybe one of the best campaign in the series.
And Reach is, you know, Reach is the big Bungie send-off. That's not an unimportant part of the franchise. That's a phenomenal game in its own right. It's better than Halo 4, I thought. So, anyway. But, yes. So that's the reports about Halo. Not a lot of news here. Apparently Halo 5 will be about the people who kill you on multiplayer maps.
Yeah. When you go outside the boundaries or you die for some, like, weird kind of unexplained reason, then it just always says, you were killed by the Guardians.
So yes, just as Halo 4 tried to contextualize narratively the entire existence of multiplayer by having the Infinity and whatnot, Halo 5 will be all about this major unexplained part of the Halo universe, the Guardians.
And I can't wait until the next game where they try to contextualize how when you reload a half-empty clip, it's just like all the bullets in that half-empty clip just go into some like magical ammo pool you have that just exists somewhere.
That will be the subtitle of the game, exactly. What you just said.
Yeah, great subtitle, very catchy.
Yes, so...
I mean, it would make the box art really easy because it would just be that whole subtitle would take up the whole box, so you don't need to put any box art on it.
All right, so Sean, assuming... Yes. Okay, Halo 5 is true, that's confirmed, that's coming out. But assuming the whole...
No, it's all a ruse! I don't believe it, they're not making another Halo game, that's bullshit.
Assuming that the Master Chief Collection stuff has some level of validity, is this what the Xbox One needs...
I don't know. Like, not... No.
It's weird to me because I think this is insular because a big Halo remake collection, that only applies to the pre-existing Halo fans.
Yeah.
And many of those, I'm sure, have already bought an Xbox One. And the ones who haven't... Like, I'm a big Halo fan, you're a big Halo fan, but that one franchise isn't enough to make us go buy this system.
No.
And we kind of both feel like maybe that franchise's best days are behind it.
Yes.
So... I don't think this is something that's going to expand that user pool or anything.
Not especially. Like, I don't know how... Like, if they want, they need to reinvigorate Halo in, like, a really big way if they want it to draw more people in, because I think as a franchise, it's just getting kind of tired, you know?
Yeah, and Halo 4, you know, straddled this weird line in the multiplayer where it was trying to still be Halo and then also be Call of Duty 4.
Yeah.
And I think that just kind of alienated everybody because it wasn't quite what anyone wanted. The campaign was really good and everyone liked that, but on the multiplayer side, and even the campaign, I think.
And then the way they handled the story in the campaign was really.
No, it was not.
Dumb. Like, yes. It was like a really poor way. Like, even though they did a really good job with the Master Chief and Cortana characters, it's like. The overarching story of Halo 4 like, barely makes sense to me, and I've read most of the books, you know?
Yeah. No, the story was gibberish, and it was a fun campaign, but it also had some repetitive parts that didn't feel fully like Halo. So Halo 4 just had this kind of identity crisis, I think.
Yeah.
And if Halo 5 could be its own thing and its own new thing and feel like something we haven't quite seen before, you know, that's what it needs.
Yeah.
I don't think it's any, you know... It's not a coincidence that I think a lot of the games that are doing big right now and people are really excited about are either new IPs or entries in IPs that feel like they're doing something really new. So, like, you've got your, you know, Watch Dogs coming out, which doesn't look quite like any game we have.
Mm-hmm.
And Titanfall has, you know, Call of Duty roots, but it's a very different kind of spin on the multiplayer
suite.
Yeah, but
it has jump packs, so.
Yes.
And mechs.
Yes. And you know, Infamous Second Son, that's a sequel to a pre-existing series of games, but it also kind of did things very differently. It also has the best graphics of any game out there right now.
Yeah.
So, you know, there was just... And those games that are creating excitement feel like they're doing something that we haven't seen before. Halo would need to do that if we were going to be bringing more people on board.
Yeah.
So, it's interesting.
This is the, you know, Halo's kind of... is getting to be a pretty old franchise at this point, and it has not had... a long break, you know? Like, there's just, right. like, it feels like there have been Halo games coming out every couple of years. I mean, there has been since 2001.
Yes.
And that's a long time for any game franchise to just keep on putting stuff out there, you know?
And all of them are really good games. Some of them are my favorite games ever made, but it also hasn't had, like, its Call of Duty 4 moment where the franchise was reinvented and reinvigorated.
Yeah, well, because, like, Halo 1 was the Call of Duty
right.
4 moment, yeah.
No, that's what I mean. It's just, it's weird because that's part of what... And that's what Call of Duty needs now, and it's not getting.
Yeah.
Is this?
Hey, it's getting Kevin Spacey. That's all any franchise needs to do. Halo 5, that's what the other character is. It's fucking Kevin Spacey under that goddamn helmet.
Sure, if Kevin Spacey wants to voice a character in every video game...
No, not voice, like full body everything. It's his goddamn performance. For fuck's sake, I don't mind if it's FMV Kevin Spacey. I would prefer if it's FMV Kevin Spacey that they just put in there.
So make a Sega CD game with Kevin Spacey?
Yeah. Halo CD.
I want one of those Sega CD games where you're, like, watching all the security cameras at night.
Yeah, and like
Kevin,
Night Trap, yeah.
Yeah, and Kevin Spacey's, like, the guard or something.
He's the killer.
The killer?
Yeah.
Oh, nice. I think what we're getting here is the world just needs more Kevin Spacey in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's what this podcast is really about at the heart of it, at the end of the day.
All right, so anyway, that's all the big news there was this week. A couple of game announcements like that. Otherwise, fairly slow. Was there anything in movies? I don't think so. Oh, I've heard about something interesting that I want to talk about really quick.
Okay.
The Digital Bits, which is sort of the oldest and industry-leading site on the web for sort of DVD and Blu-ray news. They go back to the 90s before DVD. They were one of the proponents of making DVD one of the, you know, lead formats.
I thought you were going to say they were one of the proponents of, like, fuck DVDs, VHS is still where it's at, motherfucker.
No, I mean, people forget this, there actually was a format war around DVD,
yeah.
And it was with DivX.
I mean, there's always a format war.
Right. Yeah, and they
you
were.
You always forget who the other dude was.
Yeah. Oh, well, and for instance, Digital Bits called it for Blu-ray months and months ahead of time and stuff like that. So anyway,
I'm still holding out for HD DVD. It's gonna come back, man.
It's gonna come back. All right. No, but anyway, they're a really good site for that, and they had a report yesterday that I thought was really interesting, and they were commenting on some other reports that came out this week about the possibility of the original unaltered Star Wars films coming to Blu-ray soon because. Those are out of Lucas's hands now.
Yeah.
He doesn't control them anymore. And it's an interesting report, because what they taught... There's been some conflicting reports this week. I think it was... I forget the specific websites that were reporting these things. But one, I think, was Ars Technica had a report or something about how they believe that that's not going to happen because Fox technically controls the rights to those original films still. And that would be, Disney would have to work out something with them. And then there was another site that kind of claimed they had intercepted, and this is a reputable site, it sounds unreputable, but that they've intercepted an email and communication about Disney's marketing team working on putting together some...
Sounds like this is what we've intercepted their communications.
Yeah. It just means they have a source. Yeah. And it just, that they've heard that the Disney marketing...
We've got a man on the inside.
Yes, that the you Disney...
You have to keep the spy talk up, John.
Yes. That the Disney marketing team is working on some materials for a original unaltered Star Wars collection. So there's some conflicting reports right now, and what they were talking about is just that, in their belief, and I agree with this, it's an absolute inevitability at this point that Disney is going to put those movies out in that form because...
Yeah, at some point, yeah.
Because, for one, it's very clear with what we've seen from Star Wars 7 so far, the very little we know, but we know enough that they are aiming this at fans of the original trilogy, hopefully bring some new ones in, but it's not like the prequels where those were kind of kids' movies again.
Sure,
this
yeah.
is going to be, they are following those up, they're putting Mark Hamill and Harrison Ford and Carrie Fisher in them, and they want to appeal to those people, and it would be a very easy way to get everyone back on board and sell a lot of DVDs and Blu-rays to put the movies out in the form everyone has been asking for, you know, 20 years now.
Yeah.
So anyway, but at the same time, it sounds like there's been a major fan restoration effort going on to get those movies out in HD, and I'm waiting on getting sort of some materials for this so I can look at this, but like someone has over at the... they work out of the original trilogy forums, which was a big forum back in the day before Star Wars had any DVD release, and then after it was just the special editions. I was on there for a while back then, and there's this fan effort over there where this guy, the user's name is Harmy, you can kind of look this up, and he's basically reconstructing the original three movies in their original theatrical forums for HD and with specific Blu-ray ISO, so you can burn your own Blu-ray copies of them, and apparently it's amazing. He used an original print of Star Wars to match color timing and things like that. So it sounds really cool. I would love to get my hands on that and look at that, because that's one of the other things, is that even if you have a copy of the original unaltered trilogy, the color timing can be way
sure,
off because
yeah.
of degradation and things. Or having to blow up a non-anamorphic image to fill your whole TV, mm-hmm. which can mess things up. So I just think that's interesting.
Yeah.
That's kind of the number one thing I want out of Star Wars 7.
Yeah, out of like Disney getting Star Wars is just... get a very good version of the original movies that we can watch.
Yes, because that's... it's weird. I think there's this stupid adage out there that, you know, oh, Star Wars fans will never be satisfied. I would be totally satisfied if I just got the simple... even if it was on DVD. I don't care.
Yeah.
Just a good condition copy of the original unaltered trilogy. I'm good. I'm out. It's like, that's all I need. I just want to put that on my shelf, and then I can be done. I don't need to collect anymore. I don't need to see any more movies. That's all I want.
I'll be satisfied when they invent a real working lightsaber. That's when I'll be satisfied.
Okay. That's what you want.
So maybe they're right. Maybe they're right when Star Wars fans won't be satisfied, but God damn it! One day.
It's just funny because every time a new Star Wars release comes out, sort of the cynics of the world say that, and it's like, well, but the reason is they haven't given us anything close to what we want every time it comes out.
Yeah.
So that's kind of hilarious. There is that 2006 DVD release both you and I have of the original versions
yeah.
in deplorable Laserdisc quality.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, there's
which
a
certain, has its charm to it.
It does.
I kind of like it.
I like watching the movies that way because that's how I remember them from my youth, too.
Yeah.
Watching them on VHS tape. But, you know, we are in the modern times. Maybe it's time to get with that.
Maybe it's time, if we're in our modern times, maybe it's time to remember our past, Jonathan, and not lose touch with where we came from.
Exactly. I just think it's crazy that, you know, this is an era where any classic movie you can get in just pristine quality,
mm-hmm.
except the biggest trilogy of
yeah.
all time. You can't get those.
Yeah.
You can get them, but Darth Vader shouts no.
Yeah.
So, in any
yeah.
case, let's move on to something better.
Okay.
Sean.
Jonathan.
Godzilla.
Rodan.
Just want to name some monsters.
King Ghidorah, Megalon, Gigan.
Anguirus.
So, Mechagodzilla. Mechagodzilla 2. Mechagodzilla 3. I guess Mechagodzilla 3 is like Kiryu or something. I don't know. It's bullshit. Anyways.
Space Godzilla.
Mutos. Destroyer.
Alright. So, Sean, before we talk about the movie itself.
Yes.
Hopefully, some point over the summer, we'll do a full Godzilla podcast. Talk about the history
yes,
of this character.
Like
I know you would like to. So, we just haven't had time to put that together yet. And May is a crazy busy month. We've still got a lot to go, May.
Yeah. There's the X-Men.
And Watch Dogs.
Oh, God. Oh, yeah. That's right.
Yeah. So, a lot to go yet. But anyway... Sean, I want you to explain sort of in brief form, what's your relationship with this series and where are you coming at this movie from?
Okay, right. So there have been 28 Godzilla movies that have been released. I guess if you count this one now, 29. And you don't... For this entire discussion, like, we're not talking about the 1998 American Godzilla movie. That does not count. Like just any time I'm, like, talking about Godzilla movies, that one does not count in any way, shape, or form. So there are now 29 Godzilla movies. I have seen all of them. I've seen most of them multiple times. I've seen several of them, like, probably in the double digits of times. Because, like, these were a lot of them ones that I had on VHS when I were a kid, like Godzilla vs. Mechagodzilla. You know, those were, like, the kind of movies I just watched fucking all the time, you know? So I'm a huge, huge Godzilla fan. I love the franchise. Even though I recognize a lot of the movies are awful, Godzilla's Revenge, or All Monsters Attack is another title that movie goes by, is one of the worst movies I've ever seen, hands down. It is worse than the American Godzilla movie. Like, it's just, like, it's still a Godzilla movie, but half the movie, it's like 40 minutes long, half the movie is fucking stock footage from the shitty Godzilla movie, so even the stock footage is not from the good Godzilla movies in that movie. So yeah, all, like, so I recognize that a lot of the franchise's movies are fucking awful, but I still love the franchise. I think some of the movies are great. Like, even, I don't think that the only good Godzilla movie is the original Godzilla movie. I think some of the Versus movies are legitimately just good movies on their own, but if you're a Godzilla fan, you know, you love them. So yeah, like, that's where I'm coming to this from. Like, I'm a huge, huge Godzilla fan. I love the series, so.
What's your favorite monster outside of Godzilla in the series?
My favorite monster? I mean, Mechagodzilla's really fucking cool, you know? Especially the original Mechagodzilla design is my favorite. So I'd probably say Mechagodzilla.
Okay, just curious.
What about you, Jonathan?
My history with Godzilla, yes, or my favorite monster?
Both.
Okay. You know, I don't have a ton of experience with Godzilla. Sadly, you know, the character wasn't a part of my childhood.
Yeah.
I just kind of missed out on that, I guess.
So you just say, like, that just sentence just means you didn't have a childhood to me. Like,
okay. I'm sorry. But I guess my introduction, my first sight seeing a Godzilla thing was that terrible 1998 movie. Mm-hmm. And I hated it. But, you know, the 2 years later, Godzilla 2000 came out.
Yes.
And I saw that and I was like, where have you been all my life? That was great.
Yeah,
that's awesome. And it's funny because I dragged my little brother and my mom to see that with me, Godzilla 2000.
Yeah.
And they didn't know what the fuck they were watching. Because that's Godzilla 2000 is a weird movie. It gets some of the stuff near the end.
I mean, compared to most Godzilla movies, okay, not really. It's kind of an error. Right. Like, you haven't watched Godzilla Final Wars yet.
I haven't.
You don't
know
what a weird Godzilla movie is.
Yes,
dude.
That's true.
you haven't watched Godzilla versus the Smog Monster. That's a weird movie.
Anyway, but I really liked Godzilla 2000. That was a good movie. But, you know, in part because the availability of these films is so tough at this point for a lot of them.
Yeah, for some of them, it's just like Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla still has not had a good release, which is my favorite Godzilla movie. So
I was researching this. It did briefly get a bilingual, fully subtitled DVD release here, but it was so quickly out of print that now it goes for hundreds of dollars.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, I don't have that kind of money. I wish I did.
Yeah. So anyway, I mean, at that point, you could just import it from Japan for cheaper.
Yeah. Just buy the original fucking film, you know?
Yes. I know. It would, yeah. Anyway, so yeah, that's one of the only major original Godzilla films I've seen is 2000. I'm sure along the way I've seen some other ones from the course of the series. Yeah. But really, you know, my biggest touchstone with this franchise is Gojira, the original 1954 film by Ishiro Honda. Saw that when it first came out in the U.S. in its uncut form in around 2004. That was its first kind of release here. And
yeah,
I really,
that was the 50th anniversary.
Yeah. And that movie definitely had an impact on me. And then when it came out, the awesome Criterion edition of that film, which is packaging-wise my favorite Criterion collection edition. It's so fucking awesome. But anyway,
it has like the little pop-out Godzilla.
Yep, and it's got just the artwork on it. It's phenomenal. It's awesome. So I watched it again when I got that on, you know, that Criterion Blu-ray, and then I saw it again in the theaters recently. And that's a movie I really, really love. And I think it's kind of interesting that that's kind of my touchstone for Godzilla, because I really felt watching this new movie that that's kind of where a lot of their inspiration came from, and yet at the same time, not. It's very interesting how it draws from the history of the franchise and from that first film in interesting ways. But we'll talk about that later.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's kind of where I'm approaching it. So you're approaching it as a big Godzilla fan, lifelong Godzilla fan.
Yes.
More for me, I'm approaching it as a movie first and foremost, with some knowledge of the franchise, but more just I wanted out of this movie a really good film. And I do like Godzilla as a character, and I love his design from the films I've seen him in and stuff. Mm-hmm. And his roar is awesome.
Yes.
And I wanted to see a good movie that really utilized all that. So in any case, that's where we're coming from on it.
Yep.
But let's recap. You kind of gave your spoiler-free opinion early on, brief.
Okay, right.
But I want to hear... The people know what I think about this movie. I've published two fucking articles about this. Let's hear what you have to say about it.
Okay. So, yeah, this movie is kind of... Like, in in-depth critique, I guess I have, like, a lot of sort of mixed feelings about a lot of it. I think the first act is fantastic, and the third act is really, really fucking cool. Like, the Godzilla fight is really well done. But I think the second act is really slow, and I just, for the life of me, I could not give two shits about the Aaron Taylor-Johnson character. Like, he...
Okay.
I thought he was incredibly generic, and that whole human plot, which started out, like... You know, kind of generic with, like, the Bryan Cranston character. But Bryan Cranston gave a really, really, you know, really great performance. I really sort of connected with the character. And then when he exits the film, I mean, yeah, spoilers, he dies, like, 30 minutes in or whatever. When he leaves the film, and the film, like, all the rest of the human drama then basically lies on Aaron Taylor-Johnson's shoulders with, like, a little bit of Ken Watanabe in there. I think the movie just gets really slow, and it does a really strange thing where it sets up a fight between Godzilla and the Muto like six times before the finale and then just cuts away. And it does, like, the first time it does that is the most frustrating, but then I was like, okay, maybe it's kind of going for this thing. And when it keeps on doing it, it gets really grating to me in a way that's like, I think the pacing of the movie suffers from the fact that it only has one fight. I think it needed to have, like, it needed to have, like, one more, like, smaller fight. The first time Godzilla shows up, they should have had, like, extended that moment out some more, and I think that would have made that whole, like, long second act stretch a lot more bearable. But when you do get to the end, like, that fight is really, really satisfying and really well done. And then when, you know, the movie's over, like, I left happy, you know? Like, it's, I think the middle stretch is a bit boring and too long. That is a criticism that I could level at most Godzilla movies. And so, at the end of the day, this movie feeling like a solid Godzilla movie is exactly basically what I wanted from it. Like, when I was watching it, I mean, for fuck's sake, when it starts up and then, like, when they get to the nuclear power plant and there's the larva thing, like, on the, like, nuclear reactor or whatever, sucking the energy, I just had this moment of, like, holy, this is a fucking kaiju movie. Like, it feels exactly like a Heisei-era, like, Godzilla versus movie or, like, the Gamera trilogy from that era, from the 90s. It feels just like that kind of movie. And then it kind of loses that feeling in the middle and then gets it back, I think, at the end. And it's kind of strange that way. But I think I still think it's a really fun movie.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I disagree with some of that, just in that I had no problems with the second act of the movie. I think the most interesting issue to talk about here critically is the times in which they do cut away from a possible fight.
Yeah.
Because there are, and it's interesting, I still don't feel like I have my mind fully made up on how I feel about
that.
Yeah,
and that is like, and it is because I haven't looked at a whole lot of the criticism, but like you can't, if you're aware of like people talking about the movie at all, you know that like that is the main thing that people are talking about is like,
they don't think there's enough Godzilla in it.
Yeah, and there's like there's a weird thing where I think there are two sides of the argument that are like arguing at each other, and both of them I feel are like really extreme, where there are some Godzilla fans who are like, this isn't even a Godzilla movie, like Godzilla's barely in it, he is like, the plot's not focused on Godzilla, which it's not, but that's fine, like that's true of most Godzilla versus movies, that's totally fucking okay, and there's people that are saying like, the movie's awful and I can't like it because of that, and I'm like, why? And then there are other people who are like, no, that makes this movie a masterpiece because it's holding off the tension and that stuff. And I think those people are going way too far because I think the movie does not... I don't think, like, teasing the fights is the same thing as, like, what the original Godzilla movie does or, like, Jaws does with not showing the monster. Like, this is not Godzilla 1954. This is a Godzilla versus movie, you know, so...
Yes and no, and I think... I agree that there are those two sides out there, and both of them don't make full sense to me. I come down in the middle, though I am on the side of, I think this movie did exactly what it needed to do with Godzilla. I actually disagree with the statement that he's not the focus of the movie. I think, certainly on a thematic level, and I think where the narrative points towards...
I would say the plot, like you, this movie feels to me, which is true of most Godzilla versus movies, that this feels like this was a kaiju movie where... Because there are two kinds of kaiju movies. There's a kind where there's only one monster... Like destruction, like a rampage movie. That's like the original Godzilla's like that. That's like King Kong. That's like Rodan. Like most of the original kaiju movies were like that, where it's just one monster and the plot is him destroying the city and then the people trying to stop him. And then that turned into the versus movies where it's two monsters fighting. And most versus movies tend to feel like it's the villain monster. It's like their rampage movie, but then the hero monster comes in and stops that rampage movie. And that's like kind of like what this is, that the plot is mostly about the Mutos as monsters, But Godzilla then comes in and stops them. Like, and so I agree that like the plot is mostly focused on the Mutos for most of the movie, and Godzilla comes in as... People have called him a Deus Ex Machina, and I think that's a bit dismissive, but it is more or less kind of true of the plot.
Yeah, I mean... But again, there's the narrative and thematic levels, and I think Godzilla is everything to the themes of the movies. That's the center point, that he is a... I mean, the main character is there's a huge dualistic relationship between him and Godzilla. There's a lot of...
We'll talk about that later, but I think there's more... Because the movie, obviously, there are, like, two shots that it super, like, kind of blatantly sets up. It's like, oh, Aaron Taylor Johnson and Godzilla, they're like mirrors. It's like, I think he's and the Mutos are way more similar, but...
Okay, don't get that, but we'll talk about that.
They have the exact same character motivation. It's the family and reproduction and survival.
Oh, I'm reading that differently than you. Okay, interesting.
Okay.
But yeah, well, it's interesting you talked about the criticisms, because the entire point of my second piece was talking about some of those criticisms. It was I just wanted to confront some of those head-on, because they're very tied into some of my specific readings of the movie and what I like about it. And, you know, my whole view of the movie, and as I said in both of my pieces, is just that I think... I thought this was kind of a complete package movie for me, more than I thought it would be. I thought it had... It sort of works on these two sides, and I think... I say two sides, and that sounds like I think there's, like, two halves of the movie that aren't connected. I think they're very connected. I think they flow organically from one and the other, but it's two things it does really well, and they work on one level, which is that I think it's a really genuinely, like, exciting, visceral monster movie that has some just incredible sights, and, you know, when you get to the end, so many big applause-worthy moments. It really gives you the good ones on that level. And I thought it was an engaging human-scale drama, in part because I do like the decision to very much view all of the monster action and whatnot through a human-scale perspective.
Yeah.
That's something that often doesn't work for me, though. Like, I think it's a choice that... It's funny... This movie is what Michael Bay's Transformers movies are aspiring to be.
Yeah, I had that thought too, especially in like the last fight scene, because you're right. And this is, I should have mentioned this when I give my like basic review, that the movie like visually is spectacular.
Oh, it's
like,
amazing.
There are some shots that are absolutely incredible, and they do almost for the entire movie keep a very human on the ground level perspective. And the only time it kind of breaks that is in the last fight, but even then, like, it is feels like the bigger shots are, like, from a helicopter, like, very organically. So even then, you can kind of buy it.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, that, like, ground-level perspective, I've never seen a kaiju movie, like, do that so well and for, like, so long. And it is kind of like what the Transformers movies try to do. But in the Transformers movies, it just is very confusing, and you can't make sense of anything that's happening on screen. Whereas in this, like, everything makes sense. Like, it's so well shot that it's like, there's no moments where I'm like, which monster is which? It's like, I don't know what's going on. Even though the fight happens at night, it's still, everything is very clear.
Well, they do some fascinating lighting techniques in this movie, too. But no, that's what I was going to say about Transformers, is that they try to do it from that human scale. They have mostly abandoned this by the third Transformers movie, and that's, there's no...
Maybe for the better.
Yeah, there's no coincidence that the third Transformers movie is far and away the best. They put the camera in such a way that you can see the Transformers. But in those first two movies, definitely, and especially that first one, which is the most visually incoherent to me, is it's all going to be from the human level's perspective, and most of them, they keep, like in that first Transformers movie, they keep Optimus Prime off screen for an hour and all this other bullshit, and it's not...
It's the build-up, the tension, Jonathan, it's suspense.
Yeah, well, and
because it's the thing that pisses me off, is just like, because there are people that, like, if you want to make a legitimate argument about, like, the suspense thing with, like, how late Godzilla gets brought into this movie, that's fine. Like, I think it's good that he's not in there, like, right away. But people who are just making the argument that's like, well, Jaws did it and Alien did it, so that's how the way you do it. Fuck those people.
That's like, actually, and it's interesting. I argue this, that this movie does suspense very well, but I haven't used those comparisons at all, because I think it's a very different kind of movie.
Yeah, because the Mutos show up, like...
Immediately.
Yeah, like 10 minutes in the movie, so it's not like that at all. Like, the monster, like, it's not Godzilla, but monsters are on screen, like, almost from the fucking, almost from the start of the movie, you know?
Yeah, but anyway, what point were we on before? So yes, there's this Transformers comparison where I think Transformers and several other monster movies, American monster movies, have this problem where they think they need to do this human scale perspective, and it kills them on two levels. One is the visual level. Michael Bay cannot shoot that. It's incoherent. It looks terrible. It's just sound and noise, and it's terrible. And then they also, because they have to do that, then they have to think, okay, we have to have a good human drama story with characters and whatnot. And for some reason, inexplicably, All of those Transformers movies are trying to get us invested in Shia and invested in Megan Fox and invested in his dumbass
I'm
parents.
I'm really invested in Megan Fox, Jonathan. I am super invested.
Sure. She's a beautiful woman, that's all I'll say.
Yeah, but not in the right ways am I invested in Megan Fox.
Yes, in any case. And it just makes you hate those movies more because those characters are actively annoying. The plot is actively stupid. It's just, it's dumb. Like, people say the Transformers movies don't have stories. The problem is they have way too much story.
Yeah, like, fucking...
Like, Revenge of the...
Transformers 2, like, good God.
It is a narratively complex film. That doesn't make it good.
Yeah, it's a narratively overcomplex film.
Yes. So what really amazed me about going into Godzilla is that I think it tried something that all of these other movies have tried, and it's the first one to me that succeeded completely on that level, where because I think the story is, and all of the things here, I'm not praising any of this on a level of complexity. I think this movie chose very wisely to keep the story fairly simple and archetypal, and the characters simple and archetypal, and that's what you kind of have to do if you're telling sort of this broad, worldwide story. It's something the original Godzilla does too. It's a simple story, it's archetypal, the characters are all archetypes, but the scope of it is what matters, and the scope has impact. I think the same thing here, and I think because you start with, you know, the Brody family and get to know them, and I like those characters. I like Bryan Cranston a lot. I liked Aaron Tyler Johnson in this. We can talk about that more later. I had no problem with that character. You know, I liked following them. It wasn't like, you know, they're the most compelling characters of the year or anything, but I thought they made a good proxy. I thought the movie really nailed in that first hour, even though there is some Muto action there. Yeah. It really is still focused more on the human level of we're trying to figure out what's going on.
Yeah.
And actually, if you go back to the original Godzilla, what's fascinating to me about the 54 film is that it starts out feeling like the slowest movie ever made, where it's a lot of scenes of people sitting around in boardrooms and in presentations just going through what is the science of this. And you realize about 30 minutes in, I am incredibly invested in this. Like, because they just go through the kind of clinical process of it.
Yeah, they're trying to figure out, like, what destroyed the boats and everything.
Yeah, and what's going on. And you get really engaged in it and invested and tense. And I think this movie does the exact same thing with some more kind of heavy character stuff layered on top. Like Bryan Cranston's sort of angst.
Yeah, his big, like, moment from the trailer.
Right.
You are hiding something.
He's so awesome.
Yeah.
We'll get to that later. But yeah, so I think, but you know, one of the cool things in this movie is that you get really invested just in exposition and in what's going on. And then the movie kind of takes this turn where I think what I was assuming, because I didn't know they were going to be making a Godzilla versus movie.
Yeah, it's totally a Godzilla versus movie.
So I assumed it was going to be, you know, Godzilla was going to be the threat. So they're going through, they get to the nuclear power plant, all this stuff. I thought the answer was going to be Godzilla. And when
I thought the monster at the beginning that attacks the power plant was probably going to be Godzilla. Although I'm glad that it wasn't, because it would have made no fucking sense. Because if Godzilla had blown up that power plant, you'd fucking know that it was Godzilla. Like,
yes.
Godzilla's really big in the... Like, Godzilla is fucking huge in this movie. He's even bigger than he is in most of the movies.
Yeah, they went for size.
Yeah.
Godzilla.
Exactly.
But anyway,
Go, Godzilla.
Yes. But when you get to that moment where it's, that's not Godzilla, what's going on, you get even more invested, I feel, in, like, the mystery of it.
Yeah.
And then I think there's some really cool reveals. Like, Ken Watanabe has some great moments in this. Like, I love that the first time Godzilla's name is uttered, it's Ken Watanabe saying... Gojira.
Yeah, and so that makes it like to think that all the American characters are accidentally saying Godzilla because it's like they're misunderstanding what he's saying. It's like, no, it's a Japanese thing. It's Godzilla. No, it's Gojira. Godzilla. God damn it.
That would be in keeping with American customs of language.
Sure, yeah.
Of misinterpreting things foreigners say. But anyway, so I just think on that level, you know, really fascinating. And I just, so you have this story. I liked the characters within it. I thought it was tense. It was engaging. That second act, you know, my main conclusion on a lot of that is that I think maybe the only scene that potentially bothers me is you have Godzilla's introduction, which I think is fantastic. I love how they tease it with his foot, and then we come up, and he has his roar, and it's great. And I think the cut could have been more graceful, but in the end, my ultimate conclusion on it, and I want to see the movie again to see how I would feel about this, is that I'm glad they held off on doing a big fight at the end, giving us all the action there, because I think I was thinking about this while I was writing about it. I think there's always a risk when you do an action movie or a big monster movie or anything like this, any kind of spectacle, which is where you have a 2-hour movie, you gotta fill the time somehow, And if it's an action movie, that means you're going to have action scenes. If it's a spectacle movie, you're going to have these big spectacles. How do you differentiate it so that the climax feels new and different and big and exciting? And what I think this movie does that I think most Hollywood blockbusters, even ones I love, I talked about like even Captain America the Winter Soldier in this kind of analysis, is that the climax tends to be the least interesting part on an action level.
Sure, yeah, like, that's definitely true.
Yeah, because you've already seen, you know, in Captain America the Winter Soldier, I think the climax is fantastic, I have no complaints about it, but it's the least exciting on some level.
It's usually like the big second act fight scene in action movies are almost always the best.
Yes.
Because I think they have more liberty to be creative with it than, like, the climax has to be structured in a very specific way.
Well, here's the other thing.
That limits action scene.
There's also just the element of surprise.
Sure.
So, for instance, the first time you see Cap and the Winter Soldier fight, it's all surprises, because you don't know how is Cap going to fight him, how does the Winter Soldier fight, we've only seen him blow up Nick Fury's car, how does this work? And so that's full of surprises, and then when they fight again at the end, it's you're invested in the characters, but this fight is not, it's not surprising.
Yeah, climactic action scenes are usually built around the character tension and not the fight itself. Like, it's all about the stakes of, like, the characters that have been built up over the movie.
Absolutely. And so, but if you look at Godzilla, I think this Godzilla, it has both the stakes of the characters built up over the course of the movie, and every fucking beat in that final fight feels fresh and surprising and unexpected and earned, and it's just, you know, like when Godzilla breathes fire, I was waiting the whole movie, is he gonna do it? Are they gonna have him do it? And when he does it, it's such a perfect moment. And I feel like if you'd had a fight earlier, a lot of those big moves would have happened before, and that last fight wouldn't have had that heft and surprise to it. And as a result, Godzilla is the rare movie where I feel like it peaks at the end. It's an upward trajectory through the whole movie for me, and you leave just on, for me, it was just high on the power of the movie, because that last fight just was so surprising and intoxicating and fun and satisfying on every level. And I think that they, and I also think that they do a good job in how they go through the movie, where the tension is always rising. And I think a fight, even if it was a, the part of the problem is that no fight, even if they gave us one, could be resolved before the end, unless there were more Muto for him to kill, I guess. And any fight would be a break in the tension. So you're tense, you're tense, you're tense. I think this movie has great atmosphere, great pace. And if you gave us a fight at the hour mark, the tension would break. That's the point where you snap it, and then you have to kind of rebuild it after that. And I think because you have a full arc of 90 minutes of solid tension going into that last fight, I was really, I just got more and more on the edge of my seat. And by the time you have them, you know, paratrooping into the...
the halo jump.
Yeah, the halo jump into the city and all of that going on, and the big red hues, and Godzilla coming in for that last fight, and you have Aaron Tyler Johnson's character, Ford Brody is his name, and Godzilla both just on their last legs at a certain point, it really feels so earned, and like there's been such a clear arc to get to that point. So that's kind of where I come down on that.
Yeah, sure. For me, I really disagree, and I think part of my disagreement is with my experience with the genre of that. Typically, with kaiju movies, you tend to have, it's actually usually, I wouldn't even necessarily call it a second act fight scene because it comes a little bit earlier, but you usually have a fight scene that would be more like at the end of the first act, but it's a very small fight scene, and it's like, it's a very quick one, and it's never like definitive. Like, nobody defeats anybody in the first fight scene. The monster usually like gets away, or like something happens, and so the fight has to kind of end and gets held off till the end. And then the last fight scene in every kaiju movie is always the is like this one, where it's always big, it's full of surprises, like ever all the crazy shit is shoved into the end. But I kind of disagree with you that the sense that like the tension builds. I don't think the movie like allows tension to build because of the fact that it keeps on cutting away when you're expecting a fight. I don't think the tension builds. I think it dissipates. And it doesn't break in a satisfying fashion of that a fight scene does, where the tension builds up, the fight scene happens, it's really exciting, and then you kind of get settled down, and then tension builds back up. It's like you're ready for the fight scene to happen, and then it doesn't, and so like the tension isn't there anymore. I think it's just like kind of, at least for me, it just kind of leaves of like, oh, I was expecting a good fight scene, especially because it cuts away, like you're seeing some kind of boring human shit, then it cuts back, and everything's over, and like the Muto has moved on. And it also kind of makes it difficult to understand exactly what the monsters are doing at some points in the movie, because you don't get to see what they're doing. It's just kind of like they did something off screen, and then we cut back to the aftermath, and then the monsters are kind of somewhere else. That, like, I don't understand how Godzilla did not kill that first Muto like three times in the movie, because it's tiny on its own. It does not stand a chance against Godzilla, but somehow it keeps on getting away. And it's like that, I think, kind of convolutes the movie. It makes the movie a little more confusing than it needs to be. And I don't think it builds tension that way. But I think the movie does a very good job at building tension in several key parts. I think the beginning of the movie is a fucking masterclass in tension and how it slowly builds up to the reveal of the Muto. And then when the Muto breaks free, that is that tension-relieving moment of, like, crazy shit's going down, everything's getting destroyed, and then it has to kind of settle back up and then build back up. And even if I think the movie did manage to build the tension thing, I think you can't sustain tension for that long, that there has to be a handful of moments that allow that tension to sort of, like, dispel for you and settle back down to build back up to an even, like, greater height. So I think this movie does have a pacing issue in that sense that, like, really could have just been fixed if Godzilla's reveal was not a big fight scene. Like, definitely don't do Atomic Breath or any of that, but show a fight scene, and you probably show, like, the military getting involved, and that's how the Muto gets away, because that's how that happens in, like, all these movies. It's like, it would be fine to do that, and I think it would allow the audience to be a little bit more invested. It would give Godzilla sort of more screen time, and I think it would set up opportunities to pay off stuff in the last fight scene, because that's usually also how it works out, is that there's a couple of things that sort of are teased in the opening fight scene that then you're able to pay off at the end. Okay. Whereas, like, you could have teased the atomic breath, and then that would have, in the context of the movie, made the payoff even better. The payoff is really good because everybody knows that Godzilla has atomic breath, but that's outside the context of the film.
Okay. This is really interesting to me because I see completely where you're coming from, but this is also where film criticism becomes
really, really
so subjective.
Yeah, really frustrating of, like, well, you didn't, like, get that sense of the tension dispelling, so it's like there's no...
Well, here's the other thing, though. We're both queuing into different things in the movie, though. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, movies are big, open things in this way. And so it just kind of depends on... This is all just emotions and reactions to the film, and that's so unscientific, it's tough to talk about.
Goddammit, it's pure science, and I am right, Jonathan, objectively speaking. That's what the internet told me, so I'm sticking with
it. Okay. No, but again, I see where you're coming from, and I see if that's the thing sort of you're queuing into. I totally get that. And I guess where I would say, if I had to explain, you know, kind of where in the movie I felt the tension was coming for me, it's part of how, I mean, you make a good point here of, you know, you have that great build up to the Muto introduction, and I think what it was for me is that throughout this movie, I felt enough on the level of the characters and and part of it is just the cinematography and how they shoot things.
So fucking good.
And how immersive you feel in that moment. So, you know, the first time the Muto is breaking out, you feel like you are there running alongside the characters with them as hell is breaking loose and the world is falling apart on top of them.
Yeah.
And so when you're in that kind of atmosphere, and I think they do enough to keep you invested in those characters along the way too, that's kind of what keeps the tension and the atmosphere up for me, is that even if, you know, you have a little release where the Muto breaks out and then gets away, I still want to know, as a viewer, I'm like, well, the mystery of what was that? How does Godzilla play into this, if we are going to see that? But also on the level of, you know, let's say if Ford is our sort of POV character in this, then we have, you know, why is my dad dead? What the hell happened? It looks like the world is about to blow up or something. You know, what the hell are we going to do about this? And so throughout this movie, it's this sense of powerlessness where no matter what happens or whatever things go on, until that last fight, until you are in the thick of it in the deciding moments, it feels like everything could end at any moment. And I think that's really interesting to me. And again, it's so much just on a technical level, the direction of the film. You know, we haven't even mentioned the name of the director. I talked about him a lot of these. Yeah. Gareth Edwards. I'm amazed. This is his first Hollywood movie.
Yeah.
And he puts just about everyone else to shame in this. This is whatever you think of the story and stuff, masterful piece of direction.
Yeah. Like, for fuck's sake, dude, that halo jump scene, like, good God.
That's my favorite shot in the movie, is them coming down.
Wide shot.
I mean, God, clouds. Talk about using your frame,
because
you've got these swirling red clouds.
Yeah, it just looks like a painting, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's amazing. There's a lot of shots that feel very painterly and ordered and also chaotic like that, especially in that last fight. I mean, and they do brilliant things like, you know, when Godzilla uses his atomic breath, they use the entire width of the frame
to go across it. Yeah, where it starts with his tail and then, like, you see it go up and, like, fuck yeah.
It's great. But no, so that's kind of where I'm coming from on it. And I think, I didn't have those same problems with the second act. I thought the movie actually, for me, was a really lean 2 hours. Like, I usually feel like even movies I really, really like in a theater, I could see moments that could be cut. This is awkwardly paced to me. This movie felt like it just went for 2 hours, and it did what it needed to do, and this is like the absolute leanest, tightest cut of this. And it's this is where the argument comes in, is you could almost say they held back too much, because where most action movies, again, you can look at Transformers for this, where every opportunity for mayhem, they put it in there.
Yeah.
So every time a Transformer could fight, they're going to fight for 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
This movie is, every time someone could fight, they usually hold off.
You're going to cut away.
Yeah, they usually
and
hold
that's,
off.
I think that's one of my biggest problems with the movies, is like, don't even set up the moments if you're just going to cut away from them. Like, it's a bit of a really frustrating tease of like, that would be one way to set up a lot of tension, is if like, for the whole movie, the two monsters are just heading towards one another, and then they meet in the middle, instead of like, along the way, some fight scenes happen, but they didn't happen, you know?
Yeah. No, I get it. And I think they do some, I think there are some interesting, in that second act, some just human level things going on. So, all the stuff in Hawaii, I think, is really well shot on the mm-hmm. human level.
What a great introduction to Godzilla, where he starts a tsunami when he comes in. I don't understand why that didn't happen to San Francisco, but...
Okay, well, whatever.
They got an interesting bit of physics kind of right in the first act of the movie that they kind of forgot about. Especially when the nuke goes off. San Francisco would be fucked. Like,
yes.
I don't care. Like, San Francisco's just gone.
But that's the thing with nukes in movies. They're always horribly
It's like the end of Dark Knight Rises all over again. It's like, you guys do realize that there's more to a nuke than just a big explosion, right? And then also, if a giant, giant explosion happens in the middle of the ocean, that's going to displace a huge quantity of water that is just going to destroy a coastal city. So,
yes.
Yeah.
Oh, well. But no, Godzilla's introduction with that tsunami, that's a great moment. And all those individual moments are so well-paced, too, where you start with just the little waves,
yeah,
and then you get to the bigger stuff, and then you have everyone fleeing.
Yeah, the water just starts receding out, and the dad, just like, oh, fuck!
Yeah. I especially loved it. This is also something that most movies, when they do this, is corny, but I liked it here, where they have the dog, and it's tied up, and I love that the dog even figures out what's going on and has to escape and run away,
yeah.
And I felt really happy for that dog.
The pets always live, and the children always live.
Yes.
Yeah. You have that little girl in that scene, and they make sure to show you that her dad carries her into, a store, and she gets away.
Yeah.
So you can't show the children getting fucking drowning.
I bet she got stepped on, 5 minutes later.
Probably. But that's the secret about all these movies, is that all the characters are like, oh, thank God they live, they're dead.
Yeah, they're dead.
Yeah.
In any case, and I also think there's a really good... There's that sequence where the army is transporting the nuke on the train, and they have to go on the tracks.
Yeah.
And
although, what a colossally stupid thing to do, to put that fucking nuke on that train. It's like, I get that the monsters have an EMP, but you do realize that your planes don't have to travel in a straight line to your target. You can go really high up, like with your Halo drop. That's how you avoided the EMP there. Or you could just fly around. You don't have to put it on a train and send it literally right beneath the monster, you know?
But then you don't get that train scene, which is fun. I like that.
Yeah, sure, the train scene's kind of fun, but the setup for it just makes no sense.
No, it doesn't.
You could just avoid this problem so easily. I don't know why you're just sending it right there, but okay.
Yeah. Well, anyway, we've talked about most of the story here. I mean, I do think it's... You know, one of my reflections I talked about before that I didn't get to fully elaborate on was just this thing where what I thought was really interesting about this movie is that it adopts... they've talked a lot about how they took inspiration from that original 54 movie.
Sure.
And I think what's so fascinating to me about it is that it's got a very similar tone through a lot of it.
Mm.
And it's got, at least not tone in that this is a specific reaction to nuclear war. It's not that kind of thing.
It's nowhere... I rewatched Godzilla last night. That movie, man.
It's dark, I know.
It is the most depressing movie I think I have ever watched. This movie, I don't think it has that tone at all.
Well, what I was going to say is I think early on, I think it's in that same level of it's about, you've got a lot of characters reacting to trauma. It's very dark. It's very serious in terms... And I just mean...
Sure,
I mean tone
serious.
In a...
Yeah, it's not.
I'm talking about tone in a general sense. Of
yeah,
that
okay.
You've got... It's, again, this is not a specific reaction to a country's nuclear holocaust.
Yeah.
And they made a very wise choice not to use that as the analogy here.
Sure,
because
yeah.
That would be insensitive.
And you just can't.
You can't do that.
Yeah,
but I just mean that it's serious. There's a lot of technical, clinical stuff going on with it in terms of explaining the monster, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it uses a similar kind of structure in that we tease it, and we save the big stuff for the end. And then the final images are really big and horrifying, and they do relate to the themes of the film and that sort of thing. But at the same time, so it's got sort of those, I can see where those seeds are coming from the original film. But it also managed to, as you said, it managed to be about more than that. It's a Godzilla versus film.
Yeah.
It's, it allows you to have fun with Godzilla at points. It's Godzilla's the hero in this movie.
Yeah, definitely.
So I just think it does a lot of different things well. I would like to see out of these kind of movies, but I wouldn't expect to necessarily see in one film.
Yeah, and I kind of, and this is, again, this is like due to my experience with the genre that I have to really disagree with you with the comparison. And it's something that I am actually really frustrated with a lot of the criticism around the movie, is that everyone is comparing it to the original Godzilla movie and ignoring the fact that 27 other Godzilla movies exist. This movie is so much more similar to like every other Godzilla movie than it is to the original. The only similarities that I really see to it that it has to the original movie is just because like every Godzilla movie has that, and there's nothing special about this to me that is like relate. Like the tone to me is very different. It's, I mean, it's a, like it being a versus movie just makes it completely different from a Rampage movie. And again, that's like because I've seen so many examples of these kinds of movies that like that's in where my analysis like kind of automatically goes. But it's like I just, and it's something that's like every time I see people constantly comparing it, it's like, why is everyone only comparing it to the original Godzilla movie? It's like, they are just completely fucking different. Like, you know, you watch that original Godzilla movie, and it's like, that movie ruins your entire day because it's so sad. And this movie, you leave and you're like, yeah, that was woohoo! Like, Godzilla, like, gets up and, like, saunters off into the ocean. Like, Godzilla is more of a hero than, in this movie than he is in most Godzilla movies. Like, he's only the hero in, like, five or six, really.
Usually he's just kind of, he's like the lesser of two evils.
Yeah, basically, he's usually like an anti-hero type character, and this is like, no, he's straight up just like, he's, like, you know, Aaron Taylor Johnson is the protagonist, but Godzilla is the hero of the movie, you know, it's like, have a fucking television thing, it's like, King of the Monsters, Savior of our city, it's like, okay, yeah. I thought it was very, like, and I don't have any problem with that, but I do feel like there are parts in the movie that do feel like they are trying to be like they are trying to harken back to the original film, but I think the framework of a Godzilla versus movie just kind of makes it impossible. And so it's like, to me, there is a bit of a disconnect of like,
I guess
you are trying to in some ways be like the original movie, but you're just kind of being like the Heisei era movies. And if you just realize that, like the 90s Godzilla movies, if you just realize that, I think that would have solved some of the pacing problems for me.
I guess so, and it's interesting. I mean, what you say obviously makes sense. You know more about this than I do. And I wanted to ask you about this. So, where my only point of comparison with this comes in is that absolutely this has more in common with that sort of versus style of movie, obviously, because that is the structure.
They should have
here.
Called it Godzilla versus the Muto. Like, that would have been an awful title, but it would have been a more, like, genuine title.
No, I agree. I think it's kind of weird that this is our fourth, because Japan had one just called Godzilla. So this is, and it wasn't called that over here.
But you have... If you just translate Gojira as Godzilla, you have Godzilla, then the 1985 movie, which is just its actual title, is just Godzilla. Then we have the 1998 American film, which is just called Godzilla. And then we have this movie, which is just called Godzilla. But that fits in nicely with the series, because there are three movies that in Japanese, the title is just Gojira tai Mechagodzilla, which is just Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla. There are three Japanese movies that have that specific title. So, you know.
It happens.
Yeah, for some reason, like, half the fucking Godzilla movies just have the same title.
Yeah. No, I mean, if they wanted to put out a special Blu-ray that just said Godzilla versus the Muto on it, so you could put that on your shelf
when I get the DVD, I'll just put that in, like, Sharpie, so it's like, it'll when I see the movie, it'll make sense what the movie is. Okay, it's that one, right, okay.
Godzilla versus the Muto, yes. Yeah. But anyway, where was I going with this? Oh, all I was saying, so it's got that. I just, one of the things I really do like about this movie, this is my only real point of comparison where I felt something similar to the 54 movie, is that I do think the underlying drive of the story and the characters and Godzilla's presence does relate to a specific thematic thing they're going for.
Sure, but
I thought that, like, lended weight to it. And I wanted to ask
Godzilla
you...
Godzilla versus movies kind of have that.
And I wanted to ask you if that's something that the series kept up with.
Yeah, but it's not anywhere near as strong with the original Gojira, mm-hmm. But it usually tends not to be as much about, I guess, okay, no, because the Heisei era movies totally, like, they make specific connections with Godzilla and nuclear power, and his monsters tend to do the same thing where they tend to come from, they continue the trend of, like, a lot of what the original Godzilla is about that people don't necessarily always pick on, because they always pick up on, because they usually, like, just pick up on Godzilla's nuclear weapons, is that the original Gojira is also a lot about, like, the escalation of arms, and because it's the Oxygen Destroyer is a hugely critical part of that movie and what that movie's talking about, and the rest of the Godzilla movies really kind of pick up on that in a lot of ways of, like, the monsters that come out are usually humanity trying to find a way to stop Godzilla in, like, all these different ways, and they keep on fucking themselves up in all these different really creative ways.
Yeah, well, what I think I said this last week when I was talking about the original Gojira is that it's not an allegory for nuclear power. Yeah. It's about, you know, a what-if scenario of what if we went a step further, and then a step further, and then we had Godzilla.
It's this really sort of melancholy look at the nature of weapons and how that escalation eventually just, like, means our destruction, and, like, the inescapability of human nature to make these weapons and not be able to pull out what's good from them. Because it's like, yeah, we have Godzilla, but we fail to make use of him in a productive way. We fail to, like, look at him and see, it's like, this is a creature that survived, like, direct nuclear explosions. How can we, like, take what this creature is and use that for a productive way for the benefit of mankind? We fail to do that. And then with the Oxygen Destroyer, Sarazawa never is able to have the opportunity to find a productive way to use that technology. He is forced to use it and then destroy it to kill Godzilla. So it's like, it's such a fucking depressing movie, man.
It's brilliant, though. It's brilliant.
Yeah, it's brilliant, but it's like, the movie actually makes me tear up, like, every time I see it. And almost no movies do that, but it's like...
Yeah, and I don't have
it's so depressing to
it
me.
It is, and I don't have that tear up, you know, reaction, but I do have this where I'm just like, horrified.
There's just this inescapability of it, of just like, it's so fatalistic at the end, it's just like, oh god.
The scene that really hits me in that movie is when you have the children's choir, everyone singing for hope, and it's this nation that, you know, in the context of the movie, just experienced nuclear holocaust, yeah, is having it again, and it's this sort of cry for something more, and the answer is the Oxygen Destroyer, more destruction. And on top of that, you have Sarazawa's guilt, yeah, and you have like the Takashi Shimura character and his just sadness over all of it, and it is crushing by the end. So I don't tear up, but I have this... I'm just horrified.
And there's more, like, the scene that just always gets me is the aftermath of Godzilla's destruction, because you never... Yes. Godzilla movies never show that. Like, this movie doesn't even really show it. Like, as a little bit of them in the stadium, but it's like... There's just that scene in, like the ramshackle hospital that they make. It's just, like, all the people there, and the camera just pans along, and then, like, all these people are dying, and there's, like, a doctor who's checking a kid, and with, like, a Geiger counter, and then he looks up, and he just kind of shakes his head, because it's, like, that's the part where you get, like, the nuclear warship, where you just see it's so stark, and it's just, like, 3 minutes in the movie, but it's so much more affecting to me than, like, any other war movie I've ever seen. It's just, like, it so gets across that... the aftermath of the destruction that most of these movies just can't.
No, I agree. And I you know, I think the 1954 Gojira is a masterpiece.
Yeah.
It's a phenomenal movie. This movie we're talking about today, I don't think it's on that level or anything.
But it's not trying to be.
No.
Which is what why it frustrates me that everyone's making that comparison where it's like, if you people just had seen all these other Godzilla movies, you'd have a more appropriate comparison to make and not, like, be doing disservice to this movie and the original movie.
Well, here's the thing. So I wish I had that experience, yeah, because... And all I'm saying, like, with the thematic stuff is that the interesting point of comparison to me on that is that the text of the 54 Godzilla is the nuclear stuff and escalation. It's all on the surface. It's all there. It's what the movie is.
Yeah.
And this, you know, this film, and it sounds like some of the other Godzilla, the later Godzilla movies, yeah, it's... Any themes they're dealing with are a lot more sublimated.
Sure, yeah.
And I think one thing I do like about this movie, about Gareth Edwards' film, is that I think it has a fairly interesting and compelling thematic core, and I think it does sort of sublimated, subtextual themes in a really interesting way that I think a lot of Hollywood movies don't hit that sweet spot as well for me,
mm-hmm,
where at some point it has to become too overt or something. This movie kind of keeps it... It keeps you thinking about things, even as, you know, the action gets really big. So, but maybe let's talk about that a little bit.
Okay, sure.
That side of it. Because sort of what I like as a theme in here, and Ken Watanabe basically says it at one point about, yeah, you know, the folly of man.
The arrogance of man is thinking that we can control nature and not the other way around.
Yeah.
It's like Ken Watanabe's character gets just, at some point in the movie, it's like the only place his character pops up is when he needs to say something very kind of like, mystical Japanese, you know.
Although he has some cool scenes, like
he does have some good scenes. I wish his character was just used a little bit better. And he should have put on an eye patch.
Yes, for the "let them fight" line.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's just like for no. Yeah, it's like his eye is totally fine, just for no reason. Let them fight.
But I do love that "let them fight" line. Anyway, no, but I think it, you know, and it is sort of. I think there is sort of it's a simple point they're making about nature, but I think it's elegantly explored over the course of the movie, just in terms of you have. You know, Godzilla is this force of balance, of, you know, nature. This is what Godzilla is, that force that writes nature in this movie. That's how they've kind, mm-hmm, of pitched him, is that the Muto, they're out of time. They threaten to kind of destroy or disrupt the sort of flow of evolution on the planet. Godzilla has to come out of hiding, or whatever you want to call it, to stop that, put things right again. And what's interesting in the movie is that humanity's reaction towards Godzilla is, we need to destroy him, we need to destroy all of this, we need to fight all of this. And the whole arc of the movie is getting to a point where they realize there's nothing they can do about Godzilla. He is a natural force. You just have to let it play out. And it plays out in a destructive way, in a way that there's not a just... It's not a simple, you know, happy ending where everything's fine, but it is ultimately it's better than if they had tried to nuke him in the way they do. And I think that's interesting. I think the way they sort of go at that point and how it is this, that arc plays out over the movie, sublimated under the surface, in terms of how the action progresses, I like that.
Yeah, it's like, it's something for me that I agree that it is like a well-presented theme. And this kind of maybe just goes to like personal philosophical stuff, but like I think it's a stupid theme because nothing like Godzilla exists. You know, like, there is no balancing of nature. Like, things just happen. It's like, there's nothing that, like, guards life. There's nothing that, like, protects that. And it's also, it's kind of like, I kind of think it's a little bit disappointing that the movie is like that. Like, it feels like the movie should be a lot more critical of humanity than it actually is. Like, if you're like, because yeah, humans kind of do some dumb stuff, and it's like basically their fault that, like, when the Golden Gate Bridge scene happens, it's like it's basically the military's fault that the Golden Gate Bridge gets destroyed. And it's like their plan, their plan is actually totally fine, because it's like they're just believing the crazy mystic Japanese dude that it's like, just leave Godzilla alone, and for whatever reason he won't attack humanity at all. Like, there isn't really any reason within, like, to, like, for those people to actually think that that's true. Like, there's no reason for them to think that.
But
it's, like,
that's why it's
if you just leave this alone, it'll be fine. Like, why would you ever think that?
I guess so, but it's also, I mean, but it's about, you know, the nature of things, and it's about the nature of the humans in the movie. I think the movie is more critical than that, because the specific duality between Aaron Taylor Johnson's character and Godzilla is that they are both cleaning up for their species' messes at the end of the movie, and they're paying the price for that.
Although Aaron Taylor Johnson does a really poor job of it. Can we just talk about how colossally stupid it is that you are? I mean, it's already stupid that apparently he's the only person in the fucking United States military that knows how to disarm bombs. This is like, it's really fucking convenient that this dude is around.
Well, they do.
With our, like, elite squad of guys who it's their job to do this shit. It's like,
they all get killed. They specifically show the entire bomb squad getting killed. That's the explanation.
Yeah, but it's like, there's more than one bomb squad in the United States military. It's like, it's a concession the movie needs to make to have the protagonist be where he is, but it's still silly. Like, it doesn't really make sense to me. But anyways, because he has the scene where the Mutos are all the... Like, I feel bad for the Mutos in this movie, because they are the last two members of their species. They get woken up by humanity, and all they're trying to do is fuck and, you know, reproduce and survive. Like, that's their entire... That's what they're trying to do. But here comes Godzilla, and he's like, no, you guys can't do that. And so he's killing everybody. And then, but the female Muto lays her eggs. And that's where the nuclear bomb is, because the male Muto is very thoughtful and very sweet and gives it to her as a gift. I thought that was a really kind of weirdly touching moment and, like, really cute moment of the movie, where it's like he picks up the nuclear bomb and brings it to her as, like, a courting ritual. But so Aaron Taylor Johnson and the bomb squad, they go in there, they see the bomb, they get down. For some reason, they don't just disarm it on the spot, even though they said, like Aaron Taylor Johnson's character can disarm it in, like, a minute or whatever. And so they're like, well, we need to put it somewhere else. Because we said we had a plan B, and if you say you have a plan B, in a movie, you always have to use the plan B, because if you were going to use the plan B, like, why would you even say it in the movie? It would be useless. So we have to use the plan B, because it's a script, and there was a plan B. So let's take it to the boat, instead of just disarming it right here. And so they're leaving.
They can't disarm it. It's broken. They can't get the hatch open. That's specific.
But they could... Do they say that in that scene?
Yes, they do. It's broken.
I mean,
they cannot...
could still... That's such a weak explanation. Like, how could you not just use your gun as a lever and pop the fucking thing open? Like, how broken could it possibly be? That's a shitty explanation.
The Muto was fucking chewing on it. It's a giant, you know, 50-foot monster.
That would make it easier to... That would mean it's broken open so you can, like, fucking defuse it.
I think all the metal is, like, corroded and crashed in on itself.
Then you can pop it open with a... Like, the thing is designed to pop open. You could use a lever. Like, I think that's a really shitty explanation. And I couldn't even hear that line in the movie.
Okay.
So, to me, it was just they were leaving for no reason. And because it could at least... Because they do show him later when he's on the boat. He, like... very feebly tries to open it, and then just kind of gives up, and is like, eh, whatever, fuck it. And but so they're leaving, and then he's leaving, and he stops and turns around and is like, "This is the dude who's the guy who disarms the bomb. He's the most important person on the mission." And he then decides to go back in and destroy the eggs instead of like being, "Hey guys, like, one, this isn't that important. Like, we can do this fucking whenever. Like, if we don't solve this, if we die here, like, they're going to get killed in the explosion anyways. So, like, this isn't that pressing. The eggs aren't going to, like, hatch in 2 fucking minutes. But let's just blow them up anyways. Get someone else to do it. Like, he's the most important person on the team. You motherfucker, stick with the bomb because you're the dude who disarms the bomb." Very stupid decision. And because what happens is then he gets caught in the explosion and, like, breaks his leg or whatever. And so now, like, he's basically useless.
Okay.
Yeah. So I just want to say, that was a massively stupid decision to make. Incredibly irresponsible.
All right.
What the fuck were we talking about before I went on that rant?
I don't remember.
Okay.
At this point.
I think it was something... Oh, it was about the duality between Godzilla and Aaron Taylor Johnson's character.
Yes.
Right. Oh, yeah, because they're cleaning up after their own species.
Well, and they both have the same job. Yeah.
Although it is important to note, at no point does he ever disarm a bomb. We are just told that he is the bomb disarming dude. He never does it in the movie.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so I just thought that was a weird point that it's like they just say, like, I think it was such a weird decision that bomb does not get disarmed. Like, I thought it was so strange that when he's on the boat, he doesn't disarm the bomb. Like, I have no idea why they didn't do that, because it's like, nuclear explosion just feels like, you're just, like, making this weird, obvious plot hole of, like, the movie would, the fucking city would be destroyed. Like, there's no way that bomb got far enough away on that tiny little fucking fishing boat in 5 minutes that San Francisco would not be destroyed.
Well, here's the change I would make.
Yeah.
I understand from a thematic level why the bomb has to go off. I think the follow-through is poor on that.
Sure.
They needed to say, because the whole point is that humanity fucked up so bad in putting the nuke in there that this was an inevitability and this is bad.
Still posit that humanity, like, really, like, that was not that... Like, the shitty decision they made was, like, doing all the shit with the train and stuff. But, like, the actual plan was not that bad.
Anyway, but all I'm saying is that if they had scenes afterwards where San Francisco really... It became like the city in the beginning of the movie where it was
decimated. Yeah, because it would have been like, you know, it would have been hit by a massive tsunami. There would be huge amounts of radioactive fallout. Like, you know, you'd have the scene like in the original Godzilla where the dude's looking at the kid with the Geiger counter and looks up and is like, he's going to, like, die of horrible fucking, like, cancerous defects now, so there's nothing we can do to stop it.
That would have been a more interesting ending of the movie to me, because it feels like that's what it's building to, again, where it's Godzilla dies.
It's like, it feels like it's not that critical of humanity, because the end of the movie is so happy, and it's like the bomb just kind of goes off with no consequences whatsoever.
That's a problem. That's one, thing I definitely think about this. But, you know, and again, and it feels like they're building towards it, where Godzilla kind of collapses and dies out of, you know, trying to, you know, fix the problem he was in charge of fixing.
Yeah.
Same thing happens to Ford. They both get back up in the end. But we'll see. It's interesting. Where else do you want to go with this?
Yeah, okay, so I want to just sort of expand on what I said earlier, where it's like, because the movie, like, you just brought up one of the scenes where the movie does, like, very, very clearly wants to set up this duality between Godzilla and Fort Brody. It's in that scene where they both collapse at the same time, and it's in the earlier scene where they're both in the city and they're kind of, like, looking at each other before Godzilla gets, like, consumed by the smoke or whatever.
And it's also, that's an important moment, though, because that's the first time a human sees that Godzilla, he understands what Godzilla's purpose is.
But it does feel like there is, like, those scenes very much are trying to make that connection. But to me, like, I feel like there is a much stronger connection between Ford and specifically the male Muto, because it's like, one, like I said earlier, the Muto's entire character motivation is to reunite. Ford's character motivation is to get back to his family. Like Ford has already reproduced, but also, critically, because they're both trying to get back to their mate and fuck. Because Ford, at the beginning of the movie...
Doesn't,
like,
get any.
Yeah, exactly. Like, they're setting up this, like, he and his wife are going to get on, because he hasn't seen her in, like, 18 months or whatever, because he's in the military, and they're about to get it on, and then he gets the call, and so he gets, you know, he gets blue balls. He has blue balls for the whole movie. He's trying to get back to his wife to fuck. And it's like, and to me, I thought that was intentional until you get to the end of the movie, and they're trying to draw a comparison between him and Godzilla, and I was like, what? Like, you had this really, like, I thought actually cleverly set up connection between him and the Muto, because
you know, Ford is like following, ever since he goes to the evacuation zone in Japan, he and the Muto are following like the exact same path the entire time until he breaks off to, and then he like meets up with the female Muto with the train. But it's like for like all across the ocean, like he's following him. He's like, they both go to Hawaii. They're both going across the ocean. Then he gets to California first. It's like they have the same character motivation. And then also the Mutos are just trying to survive. And, you know, fucking Walter White has the slide where he's like, they're going to blast us back to the Stone Age or whatever. It's like, it feels like it, like humanity, what they're trying to do is also to survive in the face of these giant monsters. It's like, I see a much bigger connection there, but I feel like at the end, the movie doesn't like realize that it's made that connection.
I mean, I see where you're coming from on that, although I feel like you're ignoring a key part of Ford's character, which is that he could get back to his wife in much easier ways, and he specifically decides to go with the responsibility of being with the military and trying to stop this, and going into the city, the whole paratroop, the halo jump and stuff.
But there's no other way for him to get into the city at that point. Like, he has no, like, the whole, I felt like he had, like, five lines in the movie where he keeps on, like, basically saying, like, I need to get to my wife, so I'm going to hitch a ride with you guys on the train. And it's like, you have to put me on the... Even though it seems like at some point he should have been able to get his wife, like, I don't understand how he gets to where the train is. Like, something weird happens at that point where it's like, why didn't... Because that's, like, I think if that's in, like, Northern California or something, like, that's, like, he could have just, like... And that was, like, he got there while he was on his way to San Francisco. I don't know how he didn't end up in San Francisco before the train shit, but...
Okay. Well, but I mean, specifically though, he starts out with that motivation, but he eventually realizes, especially in the San Francisco scene after the halo jump, he keeps going away from thinking, you know, I'm just going to go to my wife to I have a responsibility to fulfill.
But if he doesn't defuse the bomb, like, his wife is going to die anyway. So I don't see, I like, it feels to me like that's his, like, he does have that, like, but I think it's a dual motivation, but the primary motivation for most of the movie is to get back to his family, because...
But I do see the... But they also don't bring in the specific Godzilla connection until the end, so I don't think the argument there is that he's been Godzilla the entire movie. It's that in this moment, he is identifying more with Godzilla than he is with the Muto, because he is now preparing himself to die. When he gets on that boat, any of these moments, he is completely open to it. He doesn't want to, but he knows it's likely he's not seeing his family again, and he knows it's a... And, like, the way I agree that I see where you're coming from on the scene where he burns the Muto eggs, that's stupid of him.
Yeah.
But, again, his whole thing is that it's a responsibility thing he has to do this right now. Again, the logic is flawed there, but it's these moments of again and again turning around and going for the larger responsibility rather than easily reuniting with his family or something, or getting
but
out
he
of
couldn't
this.
Like, he has no opportunity. Like, if he doesn't do what he's doing, there is no, he has no out, I guess. Like, in like, I think that would be a really compelling theme if he had an out. Like, if he had this choice and he makes this more selfless choice, but there's at no point does he do that, you know?
Okay.
Yeah. It's weird. It's a weird, like, because it's like, it's a very good movie, but I feel like there are a couple of parts where it's like, it could have been, to me, it could have been really great if there were a couple of tweaks here and there. And it's like, and some of it just feels like they maybe didn't understand fully what their movie was when they finished making it or something. You know, it's okay. There's a weird... Like, it doesn't have, like, a full-blown identity crisis, you know? It's not Amazing Spider-Man 2, but it
does have...
Don't
even talk about them in the same sentence.
But it does have, like, a little bit of, like, it kind of needed to find itself a little bit more, I think.
Okay. And I guess I disagree with that, but again, I see where you're coming from on that. So, I feel like we've talked about most of the relevant parts of this movie.
Sure.
Godzilla, to kill the final Muto, rips its mouth open, breathes atomic breath down it, and decapitates it. That was fucking amazing.
Yeah, that was cool. I wish that fight was a little bit... Like the fight had, like, that moment in the first atomic breath moment were really good moments, but it's like the fight was still a little bit too short for my taste. If, like, you're building up to the fight for the whole thing...
It didn't,
like,
feel short to me. I thought it was...
It's like... I was kind of hoping and expecting that there would be more of, like, a bigger one-on-one brawl between Godzilla and the last Muto. That's, like, instead he just kind of, like, and then kills her in, like, one, like, fell swoop.
It's so fucking cool,
yeah,
though.
Because he basically just gets, like, a double kill on the Mutos, because he kills both of them just kind of... I mean, there is a time in between, like, where he kills the male Muto and the female Muto, but it's, like, there is, like, he just, like, kills the male Muto... And then, like, the next time he pops up on screen, it's like a one-shot kill with the female Muto, you know?
I do love how he kills the male Muto, though, where it's the tail slap and then impales it. That got applause. Both atomic breaths got applause for me. It was fun.
Yeah, but it's like, I feel like the fight could have just, like, it had the big moments, but it didn't have, like, enough of just, like, the smaller moments, you know, to me, of just, like, Godzilla and the Muto just sort of, like, punching each other.
I also wonder how much of that is an effects consideration.
Yeah, that might be it.
This, I mean, it's easier probably to do that when you've got a guy in a suit.
Yeah, yeah. And it is something that's like, I'm just used to these kaiju fights being like a certain length and having like certain beats, that this one kind of like skips all of that and just has like the three big moments mostly and like a couple of scenes of them just kind of bugging Godzilla.
Yeah, it's, but I mean, I wanted to talk about the effects here because, sure. All right, we all love Godzilla in the suit.
Yes.
Right?
We'll
how did you like Godzilla. How did you like CGI Godzilla here?
I thought it was really well done. Like, I didn't think I would immediately feel like the character was Godzilla, but as soon as he popped up on screen, I was like, yep, it's fucking Godzilla. Like, there's no...
And part of that is the roar is so perfect.
Yeah, the roar is really good. I still, like, I think they changed the roar a little bit too much, but...
Okay.
I'm... No.
The other alternative was no roar at all in a different American Godzilla movie, I feel like.
Well, so. I mean, the other alternative would be a more, because I did read that they, like, Toho, which is sort of like, you know, Toho does not, like, just give people stuff, you know, like, you kind of have to really ask for it. But they gave him the original sample of the roar. Part of me just kind of wishes he hadn't even done anything with it. The roar is so good.
Yeah, but it's good, and I think, you know, I saw this in a Dolby Atmos theater where you've got, it, that's like a 64-channel sound system, and that, man, there's some parts of this movie that just give you a back massage, because there's so much low end to it.
Little bass.
But no, I think Godzilla looks really good, and I even thought there was a little something to his skin and the way it moved that reminded me of how he moves in the rubber suit.
Yeah, they captured something about, like, them making him feel like Godzilla.
Yeah, and what did you think about the Muto as monsters?
It's like... I like the way the Mutos are used. Like I said, like, there's some really great... They remind me a lot of the Gauss in the Gamera Guardian of the Universe, which is one of the very good Gamera movies, not the shitty Gamera movies, where it's like, they have a lot of personality, where it's like... And they feel like animals. Like, they feel like they're trying to get together to reproduce. I'm a little bit confused about the species reproduction cycle, because they seem to kind of have a fish thing going on with the egg sac and everything, but they also have this, like, alien-esque parasite thing that set up at the beginning of the movie. But everyone always fucks up monster reproduction cycles because they just throw in, like, all these different forms of reproduction. So whatever. But the motivation of them trying to get back together, the little moment with the nuclear weapon, I thought all that stuff was great. But I think their actual design is really bland, especially in comparison to Godzilla. That's like, they feel like American, like, modern American monsters and not like a Toho monster, you know? Like, they basically just kind of look like, or at least the mother one looks like the Cloverfield monster, more or less.
Well, you know, we've talked about this before, that James Rolfe, who's the angry Nintendo nerd, video game nerd, and it's over on Cinemasker.com, is a huge Godzilla fan, did a whole series a couple years ago talking about all the movies. And then when he talked about this, he saw the movie over the weekend, and his point about the Muto was that
seen his review.
Yeah, and he just thought that that they were bland and that they looked like... Every American monster now looks like those, and that Americans aren't as good as designing monsters as the Japanese are.
It basically does just kind of feel that way. That it's like, and it's a shame to feel like, because I feel like they're maybe trying to make the monster, the Mutos, too realistic in a way. You know, that's like they're trying to think of some like conceivable thing. That's like, let's take like all these traits of these different like creatures and put them together into something that like makes sense. The problem is that when you do that, it just comes up with something really fucking bland. And when you have, like, Godzilla, a monster that doesn't make any real sense, that, like there's no way Godzilla could exist. Like, what the fuck, like, the dorsal fins on his back, what the fuck are those? Why are those there? They're there because it looks real fucking cool. That's why they're there. And that's, like, the Godzilla is a, like, really great aesthetic design. Like, he's like, the best designed monster ever. That even when he has a shitty fucking rubber suit, when you watch that original Gojira movie, like, there are some of those shots when he's, like, in silhouette, like, what an amazing design that Godzilla has, and it's such a beautiful aesthetic design. Most of the Toho monsters have, like, nothing is ever at that level of Godzilla, but most of them are, like, in that range, and I feel like they just went with a completely different approach with designing the Muto monsters, and that's kind of just disappointing.
Well, and it's weird, because I think that having the Muto be such in contrast to Godzilla is good on some level, and I like as an idea, but I agree the design could be more interesting. It doesn't bother me all that much, because I think the movie doesn't need the Muto to be the most interestingly designed monsters. They serve their function, but they could have gone above and beyond.
It would just to make them a little more colorful, maybe give them like a special attack or something, because every monster needs like its dumb little special attack, you know?
Well, and it's funny, I think what amazes me is that for a, you know, Warner Brothers Hollywood movie, they were able to go as far as they did with this as a monster movie, with Godzilla having atomic breath, with him being designed like Japanese Godzilla, with it having such a strong Japanese bent to it.
Yeah.
That, I mean, there's a reason the 1998 Godzilla movie has nothing to do with Godzilla, and you can't just blame the people who made it. That's a studio decision, and I think it's pretty cool that this movie got to go as far as it did. Maybe next time around, because there will 100% be a sequel.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Maybe they can go even further. And we
I wonder if they're going to try to get the rights to any of the other Toho monsters. And like, because that would be very interesting to see them. Because some of them are really outlandish, and it would be interesting to, like, even like Godzilla's like sort of like most famous opponent is King Ghidorah, and it would be interesting, like, because his design, I don't know how well that would work in their like CG aesthetic, but it would be really interesting to see them try,
you
know?
I want Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla 4.
Yeah, exactly, make another movie called Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla. Sure. I'd be pretty happy with that.
Yes, so anyway, I don't know, it's interesting. What do you want to see out of a sequel to this movie?
I want to see one that is more action-y. Like, I want a movie that more realizes that a Godzilla versus movie is an action movie and not a disaster movie, you know? Because I guess that's another one of my complaints, just, like, very briefly, because I didn't get to, like, talk a whole lot about it, but why I thought the Ford character was really bland is because he does feel to me like a very generic American disaster movie protagonist, especially in comparison to Bryan Cranston's character, who, like, is not necessarily, like, he's, you know, like, the scientist, like, dead, like, driven by his dying wife, is not the most unique character in the world, but it is more unique, you know, it is more interesting of a character to me than just, like, white 30-year-old military dude trying to get back to his family. He's, like, as about generic, I mean, at least Independence Day had that character be black and played by Will Smith, you know? So, yeah, like, that's kind of disappointing that they had the strong, like, sort of disaster movie core to the movie that I think if they just, like, fully embraced the verses, like, it would be, at least for me, it would be a way more satisfying
movie. But here's the thing. I think they had to do something a little more sane like this to get this.
See that point, but at the end of the day, I still would, like, I think they need to.
You would, and I understand that. I'm just saying that I think as a foundation, this is a good foundation. Next time they can go crazy with it. That's great.
Bring back the human, like, if maybe Watanabe, but you don't need to bring back the rest of human characters for me. I would rather, like, new human cast.
Well, sure, I liked the human characters, and I don't need that, you know,
And then Watanabe, he can get the eye patch in the sequel. There we go.
Yeah, no, in between movies, something has happened to him. Yeah. He's much darker now. He's got an eye patch.
Yeah.
Yes. Ken Watanabe, born to wear an eye patch.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you know,
he was a pirate in one of the Pirates of the Caribbean movies, but I don't think he wore an eye patch.
Yeah, I don't think he did either.
Not enough people in those movies. Fucking, they're Pirates of the Caribbean, and no one wears an eye patch in those movies.
Yeah.
One guy's got a wooden eye, but it's not an eye patch.
Which is weird, because, like, the pirates wearing an eye patch thing is not just, like, a movie thing. Like, pirate accent is just a movie thing. Or probably Peg Lake is probably just a movie thing. Like, pirates actually legitimately wore eye patches. Not because they lost eyes, but because it was like a whole night vision kind of thing. But
yes. Yeah. Anyway.
That's totally off topic.
Next week, a full discussion of Assassin's Creed 4 Black Flag.
Exactly.
No, just kidding. Yeah, so anyway, I liked this. I liked that. I thought it kind of got to have its cake and eat it too and be a really... I don't usually like disaster movies. I thought the disaster movie elements of this were well done, and certainly in terms of the cinematography and presentation.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I feel like I also got a real, you know, monster movie kick with the fight and with the monsters they presented and whatnot. So, yeah. In any case, there's not much more to say. The only big complaint I had about it when I saw it, and I even listened to some parts of this again and I liked it even less, is I really didn't like the score to this movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's Alexander Desplat, who is a really good composer, and while on the surface he mostly writes quiet scores for dramas, he would sound like the totally wrong choice for this, and I think he turned out to be, because I just felt like he didn't know how to score this movie.
Sure.
Other than kind of big generic strings. The thing is, he has scored a blockbuster before. He did the two Harry Potter Deathly Hallows movies.
No, those are, yeah.
And those have phenomenal scores, yeah. And I thought he made a really good choice with them where, you know, a lot of those movies, there's a lot of big stuff going on, but he never did, like, big musical cues. He kept it kind of small and kind of on the psychological end of things.
Sure.
And there's a couple of cues in this movie that are like that, and they're the best musical cues in the movie. It's particularly when they do the Halo jump, and there's this kind of death choir going on.
Yeah, but that's from 2001: A Space Odyssey.
It is?
Yeah.
He didn't write that. Okay.
That's the moment where, like, they go up to the monolith. And I don't think that's an original track for 2001, because almost all of 2001's classical music. So
okay.
I don't know what that classical track is from, but it's not from
okay.
this movie. Yeah.
Well, then that's the best piece of music in the movie. So yeah, no, never mind. He didn't
well, you made it. A very good choice using that track, though, because I don't think I've ever heard that in any movie other than 2001, and it is such a creepy, like, just ominous, like just...
And
like,
isn't it perfect for that moment?
Yeah, yeah, it's, like, it's such a great use for, like, for that moment, and just for, like, in a Godzilla movie, like, such a great fucking use, like, idea to pull that out.
Well, and here's the thing, here's why I was kind of tricked and forgot about that, is that that's, like, something I've heard Desplat write for a bigger movie before, and I think if the whole movie had had something more like that, it would have been better, because even in the end, in the big fight, there's some really, like, just two obvious cues, like, when Ford is running to the boat, it's just, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, or something like that, and it's like... That's not even what the scene is more subtle than that. The scene is more atmospheric and visual.
Yeah.
And so you have this music that doesn't match that. And so I didn't think it was a good score. And it's from someone who I think usually does write good scores. He was probably just out of his element here.
And like, I get that this probably was something that they just couldn't do, but how disappointing is it that when Godzilla came on screen for the first time and ruled the board in the camera that they didn't have the big bum 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 bum. Like, that's...
Yeah.
Like, you know, those Ifukube scores are so fucking good. They are so great. And there is a lot of material because he scored most of the Godzilla movies. Like, he scored, like, most of the ones in the 90s, you know, for God's sakes.
I really do have to assume they just couldn't get the rights to it.
Yeah, that's got to be it.
Because you look at that opening, they have a really good opening credits sequence
here. Yeah, which is very, I can't remember what Godzilla movie it's like, but it's very similar to another Godzilla movie where they do have the Godzilla March, like the famous one.
Which we played at the top of this podcast, and I feel like they wanted to use that there, and they couldn't, so, you know, Desplat has this very kind of generic Godzilla theme there. Yeah.
Which, like, I made the comment before we recorded the podcast when we were talking about the movie that, like, there, all the Millennium-era movies, like, they have some of the Ifukube score in there, like, they have the famous stuff, but they do have, like, a mostly original score, and those movies have, like the same score as this movie. Like, it almost, like, just sounds like the exact same, like, super generic... just does not have any of the personality or the bombast of the original Godzilla music. And the only time... So it's like, I hope they get, like, a different composer and do something really different with the music in the next movie if they can't get the, like, Ifukube stuff. Because the only time Godzilla movie scores have worked, and it's not Ifukube, it's really kind of only Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla. And that score is just completely different. Like, it's super 70s and crazy, and it's awesome and fits the tone of that movie... much better than the Ifukube score would, because some of the Ifukube scores, when the Ifukube score is not good, it's when it's in the zany Godzilla movies where it doesn't really work.
Yeah.
So yeah, I hope they figure out something better for the next film.
I would just, I honestly would have hired Michael Giacchino for this. He wrote a ending theme. Cloverfield does not have any music, but the end credits do, and he wrote that like 7-minute end credits piece, and it's like a really fun monster movie kind of thing. And I think he's a composer who just gets when you have to have fun with a score and be different.
Mm-hmm.
That's someone I would probably hire because he could probably hit a nice midpoint. But we'll see.
Yeah, but it's like it's just something that's like it's something that I attach to so much when I watch a Godzilla movie, because again, almost all of them have like a full Ifukube score. So it's like his tracks are so like memorable, and they're usually really, they're very simple and very catchy. And so it's like I'm always like singing along with the music, you know, whenever it comes on, because it's so great. And this movie just like doesn't have that at all.
So here's what I want out of the sequel.
Okay.
Godzilla versus Gamera. I want American Gamera.
They've been trying to make that movie forever. I mean, the Japanese studios have, not the American studios. That would be that would be silly if an American studio made a Gamera movie.
And I want it to have the tone of like an original Gamera movie, like super cheesy for kids.
Oh, like I would be totally down for a Godzilla versus Gamera movie if it was the Heisei era, like Godzilla and the Heisei era Gamera. That would be awesome. I don't want to see an American Gamera. That's not... The fact that there are three incredible Gamera movies is a fucking miracle. Like, we don't need to tempt fate again with that character.
All right. No, but I mean, it is amazing to me that this Godzilla movie made so much at the box office this weekend.
Yeah, like, even if the movie was shit, and the movie's definitely not, if the movie's very good, even if it was shit, if it made money, I'd be fucking happy. Like, that's the most that I wanted from this movie. I wanted two things. I wanted it to make a shit ton of money, and I wanted it to feel like a Godzilla movie. And goddamn it, did both of those. So I am as happy as can be.
America loves Godzilla.
Damn, and I had no idea. I felt like I was the only one left. Evidently, that's not the case. So that's great.
And they're going to see a Godzilla movie that is, as you said, a Godzilla movie.
Yeah, it's a
movie.
Fucking Godzilla movie. Like, and like some of those flaws that I found in the movie with like the second act being really slow and the main human character not being interesting. That is totally a Godzilla movie thing. So it's even where it has its flaws, it's the most Godzilla movie flaws. So,
all right. So it's a good day.
Yeah.
All right. So we're done talking about this movie. We're going to come back next week, obviously, for another podcast, but we're going to have another podcast later in this week. This episode is coming out on Tuesday or Wednesday. On, I think, Thursday or Friday, I'm going to put out this extra episode we're recording.
Yes.
We just got in Persona 3, the movie number one, Spring of Birth.
Movie title of all time.
Yes. Every time I say the title, I have to say the whole thing.
Yeah.
We've been talking about this movie before. We're big fans of Persona 3. They've adapted the game into a series of films. The first one just came out on Blu-ray. So we're going to talk about this in another podcast. It'll be its own episode. So if you're a Persona fan, that's going to be its own episode later in the week. And then we'll be back next Tuesday or Wednesday with our discussion of X-Men Days of Future Past. And sometime after that with Watch Dogs.
Yeah, whenever we have a chance to play Watch Dogs.
Yeah, I have no idea. But And Watch Dogs is apparently like 40 hours long or something. So
it's an Ubisoft game. Yes. So yes.
Obviously. They make you always get your money's worth. They make feature-rich games. Not always the best features.
Yeah, but there are a lot of them. That is definitely true.
Yes. All right, so anyway, that's it. Any last words?